You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. I am your host, Jennifer Yeremeyeva, and today I'm with Olga Zilberberg to talk about her new collection of short stories, Like Water and Other Stories, which is out this autumn and published by WTAW Press. Olga, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Jennifer. I'm so glad to talk to you.
Oh, it's great to have you here. I'd like to begin with inviting you to read one of the stories from this collection. It's called Dandelion, and let's let you go to it.
Dandelion. A story Oz had written nearly won a prize. Though the story came in second, it received some notice. A New York agent contacted her. I have read the story of yours and think it's wonderful. Do you have a novel you need representation for? Oz had no novel, but she did have a 19-month-old. He's very much like a novel, she told the agent. Can I ship him to you? People are telling me, since he can walk, that he's no longer a baby. Soon, he'll be ready for publication. The agent asked to see a picture. Oz sent a recent image of the child in the park holding a white-headed dandelion by the stem. The child's pale curls, backlit by the setting sun, resembled the dandelion. The agent liked the picture and asked to see Dandelion in person before shipping her child off to New York. Oz added the final touches. She cut his hair and trimmed his nails. She gave him a long bath to scrub the dandruff from his scalp and the playground grime from his hands and face. She outfitted him with a leash harness so he wouldn't be able to run into traffic. She cut off feet from his pajamas and straps from his hat to make it look more like a baseball cap. She taught him to smile and give high fives when he was too shy to say hello. Oz didn't have time to teach him to use the toilet, and this concerned her a great deal. She wrote to the agent asking for advice, but the agent assured her it would be fine. If a publisher would take Dandelion on, they would toilet train using their preferred method. I frequently advise authors to leave one obvious flaw for the publisher to edit, the agent wrote. The editors will edit, and unless you give them something obvious to work with, they are liable to start messing with the parts they better leave alone. Having done everything she could think of, Oz presented the child to her husband. Her husband was Oz's first reader. and though not very familiar with the publishing industry, gave common sense advice that helped her make sure she was on the right track. "He may have cut his hair too short," the husband said, running his fingers across the child's head. "Otherwise, he's perfect." He asked the child to point out his belly button and then tickle him until the child was squealing with laughter. "I am going to miss him," the husband said, "but I guess if he's to be published, I'll see him soon." The husband helped Oz package and ship Dandelion to New York. Then they waited. The agent acknowledged the receipt and said the Dandelion was as beautiful in person as he'd looked in the picture. A week later, she wrote to say that he was a very active child with boundless curiosity, and that she would right away introduce him to several publishers and schedule an auction. She asked if there were a code word or a particular bedtime routine that could help Dandelion relax and be still for more than a few minutes at a time. Reading books to him didn't seem to help. He wanted to flip the pages himself and kept asking to see the cats. "I'm not sure what cats he means. These old-school publishers are tired," the agent wrote. "They want to take on familiar, well-behaved projects." Oz suggested taking Dandelion on a good walk to tire him out, and then giving him a bath. When she didn't hear back from the agent, she started to worry. After 3 weeks, Oz broke decorum and wrote again to ask about Dandelion. "He's my only child," she explained, "and though I know it's already out of my hands, I do worry about his future. I want to make sure I've done my best by him." It took the agent another week to write back. Dandelion had been introduced to nearly a dozen publishers, the agent reported, but unfortunately he failed to make the right impression. It turned out he didn't do well under pressure. He kept asking for mommy and other things he couldn't have. He didn't respond well to discipline. He refused to hold hands when walking down the street and darted into traffic with such force that he took his leash with him. He was still alive, but barely. In short, no bids were forthcoming. The agent didn't see any point in trying again later. A basic character flaw made the child unacceptable to the major publishers. "Being in San Francisco," the agent wrote, "you will be tempted to publish with an independent press. I would strongly counsel against this. Publishing with a small press makes you look desperate and abstruse. If you want to make it in New York, you have to work harder." The agent sent the child back. Oz barely recognized him. He looked like a dandelion whose seeds had all blown away. He smelled like a sewer. His loaded diaper had not been changed during transit, but instead encased in a second pair of pants. Together, Oz and her husband washed the child. They hoped that once his hair was clean and dry, it would curl back up, but they were disappointed. The awful smell was gone, but the hair remained thin and straight. Oz returned to writing short fiction while her husband cared for the child. "Let's see if you still like being tickled," he said, and chased after the boy, who promptly climbed from the dining room chair onto the table, nearly turning both over as he jumped to the floor. A step ahead of his father, he ran to his old bedroom, where Oz had recently moved her desk, and went to hide in her drawer.
Okay.
Oh, that's fantastic. Thank you so much, Olga. I think any writer who has a small child or a manuscript can relate to this. This is a great example of these really pithy stories in the collection, which explore all kinds of issues, from motherhood to the immigrant experience and the nature of biculturalism and bicultural families. But I think also the challenges of the nature of reality. There is really a lot in this very slim volume, and I'm looking forward to speaking about it with you today. Olga, let's begin with your own story, which I think it seems to me shapes so many of the stories in Like Water. How did you come to writing in general and to writing this book in specific?
Right. So, in brief, I grew up in the Soviet Union, and I was about, well, I was 12 when the Soviet Union fell apart. And I come from the Jewish family, my parents were always tackling the subject of should they immigrate. So many of our, you know, friends and family members were leaving for Israel and the United States all through the 80s and the 90s. Anyway, they ended up staying, but when the opportunity arose, I went to the U.S. to study, and I landed in Rochester, New York. I went to college there, and long story short, I ended up staying here, and they ended up being there. And I think eventually I came to writing as an attempt to bridge that gap and what that meant. You know, my first career was in business, and so it was, yeah, it took me a long time to figure out how to live in two worlds. I felt like I was living in two worlds for a long time, and writing was, or the world of the imagination, provided the opportunity to inhabit two worlds at the same time. So I got an MA in comparative literature, and it took me a long time to read enough in English to understand how the publishing industry worked here, and how the the contemporary American short story, the publishable American short story, to get to this book. But I have published quite extensively in various literary magazines until this point.
And what made you choose the short story, which to me seems like an incredibly challenging genre, but you've like cracked it completely in so many different ways in this collection. But what draws you to the actual short story?
Well, it's funny. I think it's just the anxiety when I first started writing, I couldn't bring myself to reread what I had written. It felt so scary somehow. A writer can't write without, you know, revising or going back. But it felt prohibitive. I couldn't do it. So I figured that, you know, I could write a story in one sitting, I wouldn't have to look at it again.
I'm not sure aspiring writers should follow that advice, but I think it's great.
That was just the first step, but it actually helped a lot to, you know, really after 30 days of that, I had 30 stories.
And I think you were part of a writing group that met frequently.
Yes.
Did I read that right in the acknowledgments part of the book?
Yes. That writing group that really helped a lot with that particular anxiety. There's this group called the San Francisco Writers Workshop, and it meets once a week at a bookstore. Well, now it meets at a bookstore. It used to be an art gallery in the basement of an art. We used to meet at the basement of an art gallery, and it meets every week. And the idea is that you read out loud up to 6 pages of a work that you want to share, and people comment right away. So it's a sort of a cross between an open mic and a workshop. And for me, that was so incredibly effective because, well, first of all, it got me to read what I wrote. And and second, it got me to speak it in my own voice. And I had never actually heard what my voice sounds like. So, that whole idea of coming to your own voice and what that means, there's a big discussion, right, between writers, what that really means. But reading out loud is actually such a fantastic exercise for that, because while I speak with an accent and I couldn't pronounce certain words, I didn't know how they looked, I knew how they looked, I didn't know how to speak them. Right away I saw that my level of diction in my stories was very disconnected from my everyday speech, and my characters did not sound there's a big disconnect between my characters and myself, basically. The answer is what to do with that information. That took also like a long time to.
And how did it affect you being very bilingual? I mean, did you initially think about the stories in Russian, write them in Russian? How does the Russian come into it? Because a lot of your characters are Russian and are speaking, presumably Russian, but you're writing in English. So I was teasing that for myself when I was reading the stories.
Right. In the collection, I was trying to be very conscious that I do switch between Russian and non-Russian characters, and I tried as much as I could to provide to give a quick who, what, where, when at the top of these transitional stories or stories where I knew that I was switching radically from one setting to another. I mostly write in English. I have written in Russian, and I often actually use Russian during the drafting process. When I need to write dialogue, I often, formally or informally, whether I write it down or I just think it through, I go back to Russian and sound out what the characters would actually say to each other in Russian, because that really affects the logic of the dialogue. So when I have Russian characters or characters of Russian background speaking, I do go back to the Russian language for that and translate. And in workshop, the other thing I often think about is, when I approach a new story, depending on where the idea comes from, I ask myself, is this a story about the Russian diaspora, or would the story be more interesting if it were set in Russia, could this be a story about American characters and, or like non-Russian Americans, and how would that change the story? Sometimes transplanting a story idea from one cultural background into another, helps to make it a more interesting story, I think.
Well, it certainly is working for you. I wouldn't change the thing. But let's talk a little bit more about that theme, because you, it seems to me, are part of a generation of emigre writers in the United States for whom the borders between this country and Russia are a lot more porous than they were for your immediate predecessors. I'm thinking about the Sergei Davlatov, Joseph Brodsky. And so there is a lot of back and forth, and there's certainly a lot of your stories, which are very funny, are about sort of relatives visiting each other and really not getting it, which I love because we have this in my family, of everybody kind of moving around and not really getting each other's culture. How does that fact, that porousness, affect the way you craft the stories? I mean, it's an obvious theme throughout the collection, and I'm wondering if you consciously think about it or if it's just such a part of your world.
Right, that's a great question. I grew up with these stories of emigre writers about themselves, myths they wrote about themselves and biographies. I read lots of biographies, and people who viewed immigration as a tragedy, and for whom there that was a complete break, right? Brodsky famously refused to go back to St. Petersburg when Perestroika happened, and when he had the opportunity, and in St. Petersburg, people asked him and, encouraged him to come back, and they really wanted him to come back, and he didn't. He refused. It would have been too painful for him, I suppose, and I think he has written about that. But I remember the day, of his death. My literature teacher in St. Petersburg just was devastated, and it was that hope that idea that he would never come back was so just powerful. But so when I in 96, when I came here, when I flew to the US, I actually it was so soon after the after the fall of the Soviet Union that actually I didn't know what was going to happen. I felt like I was I could never go back, I carried some of that tragic narrative with me, and over the years it's right, because the tragedy didn't come true, or the travel has become only easier in my in my lifetime, and it's despite everything that is going on politically, it's still super easy to travel, and actually getting easier and easier in some ways. The visas, the visas right now are
the visas still a nightmare.
But yeah, so then what is my as a writer that took away my great tragic subject. I know. I know.
So unfair.
And it's like, well, actually, I could go back, and I could have a lifetime in Russia, and I did try. A couple of times in 2003 and in 2007, I went back to Russia for extended periods of time. I spent the summer there, and I wrote a lot of stories there. But But yeah, so I had to find. So yeah, that you're totally right. That I'm I'm turning that tragedy into comedy of disconnection, or you know, disconnect and connections. You know, the sort of unexpected connections.
Well, and the disconnections, because one of the themes that comes through, particularly in the short story that is Like Water, is the idea of a missed opportunity. And it seems to me that emigration is a great subject for, you know, the ultimate missed opportunity, that you've given up one country for another. And there are a couple more like that in the collection, and I wonder if you'd speak a little bit about that concept of a missed opportunity. Do you feel like there are a lot of missed opportunities?
Well, I mean, that was I remember when I graduated from my university and got a job at a sort of the, you know, like low level entry market research job. And, you know, and my friends were graduating from their, you know, universities. And at the time, and still in Russia, it feels like for young professionals, things happen so fast and so quickly. They were immediately catapulted in positions of great authority and becoming managers, and things were developing very dynamically for them. And I I was so like, oh my God, maybe, you know, like I made all the wrong decisions. And, you know, I've been playing this game of what ifs my entire life and what could have happened. With Like Water, I feel like, and with this book, I'm actually entering somewhat different territory. So with Like Water, my, character is in a, she's an academic, and she's married, and she, I feel like it's a post Me Too story, I wrote it very much in response to, the conversation about, sexuality and, how, you know, and the sort of the great need that I feel for women to express their point of view in the sexual exchange that feels extremely unfair. But in the story, that theme is, you know, it's indirectly my character basically has an opportunity to think back on her past and to think about, you know, herself possibly as a lesbian, I don't know if she's ready to even come out to herself, in her 40s, you know, I think she's not fully prepared for it, but she's almost there. one of the ideas there is that, you know, growing up in Petersburg, you know, in the 80s and 90s, I personally didn't even know the word homosexual, I think, or like maybe I didn't know the word homosexual, but like I didn't really know what it meant. You know, I didn't realize, you know, and, you know, people, I remember clearly people talked about how miserable Tchaikovsky might have been, but why? So it was a very, very much taboo topic. And, you know, there were no cultural examples of homosexual relationships, and that all, you know, and So it's very socially conservative in very many ways, and in many ways the culture is still that. The whole culture of the public coming out that have transformed the landscape, I think, in the U.S. has not happened in Russia yet, and it's still a very painful and very taboo topic. So my character, you know, marvels that for this is, you know, how long it has taken for her to even consider the possibility it's so in this way I'm embracing. I'm actually I'm moving to San Francisco and seeing all kinds of possibilities of relationships that people have here has really has been incredibly inspiring and has made me really reflect on the social conservatism of the Soviet society. My own upbringing, I guess.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I think that comes through really well when you juxtapose a couple of characters, you know, an older relative coming to stay in the United States or younger people going over to the Soviet Union and kind of a difference of generation, but also a deep, deep cultural divide.
Right. It's funny. There was one particular moment when a friend came during the Pride parade and or the Pride festivities, because in San Francisco it's like a week of festivities, and I took him to see some of it, and I don't think we had even a language to talk about what we were seeing, I think it was definitely interesting, but for my friend, but we didn't talk about it. We didn't have a way of talking about it. I mean, I think, you know, I, well, yeah, the only, yeah, it, like, I, you know, it was,
You still don't have the language to talk about it all.
Yes, I know. I started getting very tongue-tied.
No. But I think that's very true. I mean, I still encounter this in Russia with acquaintances and the relatives of my husband. There isn't a kind of a language or a vernacular to speak about it. And I think there'll be several more generations before they get there. But one thing that is very easy to talk about, both in Russia and here, is this universal topic of motherhood, which is another really strong, arguably the strongest strain in your collection of stories. And it's fascinating to me because you are very much a modern professional woman balancing the sort of trying to find the work-life balance between motherhood and working and raising kids. And you add into that the piquancy of the bicultural sort of parenting arc, I guess. And in doing so, you kind of turn this cherished Russian or Soviet ideal of, you know, the mother is kind of in some way sacrosanct, and you kind of let the air out of the tires of that concept in a really refreshing way. And I wondered if you'd speak to, I mean, you are a mother yourself, and you, I think that you were writing these short stories as your children were very small. Is that right?
Yeah, I wrote most of the book after the birth of my son and before the birth of my daughter. So in between, the in-between years. Yeah.
Was motherhood something that had as a topic, as a theme, had occurred to you before you started writing, or, you know, after you became a parent, or how did you kind of come to it?
Yes, I've been writing mostly. I've been writing mostly about a parent-child conflict. I've been writing a lot about, not even conflict, but the disconnect between generational points of view. And I've been writing. Some of the stories actually. I've written way before kids, but I think it's actually fairly easy to tell which ones, like my mother at the shooting range, it's really a view maybe more at so in another way, I was writing about my characters' relationships with their parents, I guess mothers in particular, and also a lot about reproductive pressure, because I have several stories. That story and Dr. Sveta end up being about the reproductive pressure. And then, which very naturally, I think, leads to the motherhood, the early motherhood stories.
And for the benefit of our listeners who don't know as much about Russia as you and I do, explain what reproductive pressure is in that, because it's you're referring to a very specific thing.
Right. In Russia, I feel I would say post-Soviet Union, there's very much at stake for people to, who are parents, to have their children, to have children, because, families, people end up depending on their children for, support in their old age. It's seen, but that's one of the explanations that reproductive pressure is basically, when you have your mother start asking you after the day after you're married, so when are you going to have children now that you have a husband?
Your mother and her friend and the lady down the street. Yes. And, I remember my first years in Russia, like people, perfect strangers would say to me, you can't sit on the stone, wreck your lady bits,
actually reproductive pressure begins when you're born as a girl. the not sitting on cold things.
You've got to protect. I mean, you're just protect, a vessel. Yeah, you're just a vessel.
Yes, right. Very much so.
Oh dear. No, I thought I laughed out loud at many of those moments. But I wanted to talk to you as well about some of your stories are like one line. And I was going through it and I thought, well, of course some of these are only one line, like, 'cause she has two kids. she doesn't have time. But then I thought there's more to it than that. But you have an amazing way of distilling a whole story and like a big narrative arc into just a few lines or a paragraph or so. And I wonder, how do you come to choose the length of a story, or does it choose you, or what is the process on that?
Sometimes, with this book, what happened basically, You know, when I was coming back to write, came back to writing about 6 months after my son was born, and I sat down at the keyboard and just started typing. And it was, you know, it was actually this repetition of that same thing. I had a very discrete time to write, and I, so like, you know, a couple of hours at a time. And I had been tinkering with novel ideas for a year before my son had been born. I was working on this historical novel, but it was very much research based, and I knew that I had no time to finish my research and to really get into the story, and I had no attention span for that. But I did what I had done at the beginning of my career. I knew that I could I could finish something. I could throw at the page something and then come back to it later and see if it's sufficient or not, or if this is a story or if I need to do revisions. At that point, I knew very well what to do in revision. But I threw at the page as many ideas as I could. And then as my time expanded, as my son grew older, and then he went to preschool, and I was able to go back and look at some of these drafts, and I ended up revising a lot of them, and expanding some, contracting some changing some, writing some new longer stories. But the process, I think, is very much about, so the shape of this book is very much about being a new mother.
I see. Would you return to the novel at any time?
That particular novel, maybe,
just the novel as a genre.
The novel as a genre. I'd like to. I have a lot of story ideas, but in another way, it's I'm exploring. I'm moving towards the personal essay right now, so I'm writing more. Mm. I do have these stories from the 90s that I really want to tell, and I've tried several. There are several stories in here in this collection where I approached some of my, you know, my some of that material, and then, you know, there are stories about coming to the U.S. So soon after the Soviet Union had ended, and landing in Rochester, New York, where I was one of the, you know, few, like, you know, for many, you know, for many people I encountered then, they had never met a person from the Soviet Union before. And so I was tasked with representing a culture, as I'm sure you can imagine what that, you know, that's like. It's a very odd position to be in, and I think some of those stories are probably better told as personal essays versus fiction. They're too unique to my personal story, I think. So right now I'm moving towards that, the memoir personal essay writing, but I do have a lot of novel ideas. It's just a matter of, I don't know.
finding the time, and also
finding ways of, somehow the novel seems so daunting or so, I have a lot of anxieties about being able to accomplish a novel, you know, having the long uh-huh. breath. There are all kinds of weird, you know, patriarchal metaphors, I think, about what the novel is and what it means to.
Particularly for Russian writers, yeah. I think it's exceptionally daunting, for sure. But this, you speak in the foreword to your book about, the process of moving from childhood to adulthood, which you say for the artist is ongoing. So hopefully that's, you know, that's a linear process for you, and we can look forward to you, you know, aging in.
I love that.
I hope so. It's a difficult genre, but it's you know, I think we haven't found anything to replace it in terms of really gripping us. Tell me, your husband, you also credit with being your first, and in Dandelion, he I think makes a brief appearance with helping you learn to write in English. And how did that happen? Does he speak Russian?
It's a cute story because. I met him in the dorms. He helped me with my luggage when I was moving into the dorms. In my first year of school, it was about a month after I had arrived to the U.S. And so it was one of the sort of the first encounters, my first encounters. He grew up in the suburbs of Philly. He doesn't speak Russian, but he and his group of friends he and his roommate in college, Jason. I probably should have credited him too, because Jason had this massive collection of movies, they used me as an opportunity to rewatch all of like the 300 movies from Jason's library, they were so great. They would stop the movie, rewind it, then act out the scene that had just happened, and then play the tape again. So that was my introduction to the colloquial English. But later Jay was definitely my first reader for many years. And I mean, still these days I try to read to him out loud what my stories. And he's, you know, he always has some fascinating things to say about it.
Oh, I think that's great. So you have a very bicultural family. You've created a very bicultural family. What are some of the pros and cons, or the gifts and the curses of that? For an individual, right, as well as for a writer.
You know, that's really interesting. That's a great question. For the writer, I think it's purely a gift, because I mean, yes, materialist.
It's material.
Oh my gosh! I mean, I would say the downside of that perhaps is that there are just way too many stories. And so, for example, with in one of the questions that I have to solve with my approach for a novel is that which of the stories do I, take up first? Which of the stories is the most pressing? Because there are so many. So many stories to tell. But you know, it's funny, you know, we've been, so Dave and I have, you know, like, we, you know, we started dating about 6 months after we met. And so we've been together for crazy long time, but we still have daily misunderstandings, or like ways of in which we're still figuring out the cultural sort of approaches, the difference in the cultural approaches to things. Like, and you know, as one goes through life, new problems keep arising. So now our son is about to, well, next year he's going to kindergarten, and in San Francisco there's a lottery system for the public school, and you know, we're going around looking at all of these schools, and we've come to understand that education means entirely different things to him than to me. I'm still trying to reconcile that, and so
Oh, well, I'm celebrating my 25th anniversary this year, and I can tell you it never gets any easier.
What I'm talking about.
Ever. I do. Yeah. I mean, my daughter's about to graduate from college, and we're still kind of wrapping our heads around, you know, how do we parent? How do we, you know, how do we celebrate the holidays? How do we do this? And I loved your story about the little boy who interprets the fairy tale completely different from his Russian emigre mother. I mean, I think that really kind of distills things down. I remember taking my little girl to a trick or treat in Moscow, and that was like a whole scene. And people were like, you should knock on people's doors in Russia. That's not good. I found it a real wealth of materials. One question I always like to ask people is, what did you learn writing this book that surprised you or revealed itself to you, or that you hadn't really thought about before you sat down to sort of put it together? And I know this is a collection that you worked on over a period of time, but what has it taught you?
It definitely you know, one thing that was interesting to see when I put these stories together is, you know, sort of discovering my own recurring themes or things that I have been thinking about for, or the things that I keep returning to, like, you know, the mother-daughter relationship, for example. I had been writing that way before I had been a mother. But it's taken a new turn, you know, now that I am a mother. And, you know, in another way, I'm learning a lot about, what my interests are actually through looking at this book, you know, or through seeing it together. And then, you know, the other very interesting thing that has happened for me is that I learned a lot from the way this book was received in the community, or what community had found the book. It's, you know, it really surprised me in the way that, say, on Twitter, and just I've been able to find the community of, like, the people who are in betweeners, right? Like the people like who, right, the Russian American community, or even going beyond America, right? Just sort of the diaspora, the post-Soviet diaspora, that is very geographically dispersed, for whom who have been super enthusiastic about my book, and but that feedback has really helped me to understand, you know, who my audience is, or who are the people with whom I'm speaking the same language, you know, even though, right, maybe it's not even, like, it's not that definitive, it's not like the single language, but who can understand the difficulty, the shades of language use. Yeah.
Absolutely. Because while this is very much rooted in the Russian emigre experience, I think that anyone who sets off to live in a different culture, in a different country, can find much in this book that will speak to that experience. You know, when I first was starting to read the stories, the story entitled Like Water comes at the end, and I thought that Like Water was suggesting that, in a way, that water kind of fills up whatever container it's in and takes the shape, that it's very malleable, that it will fill up, but it can also change into ice, or it can change into steam. And that seemed to me a really powerful metaphor for the emigre experience, that you have to be willing to change and willing to shape yourself to different contours. And then of course, water turns out to be something quite different in the story. But I think it's kind of both in a way. I think you've given voice to an experience that's very real in our time, and doing it in a really elegant way. And I really enjoyed the book.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. So we've talked a little bit about what's coming next. You're working on some personal essays. Will you continue to write short stories?
Oh, absolutely. I think I'm addicted. But it's really, you know, it's sort of like some people diary. I've stopped diarying pretty much completely. I just write short stories.
I think that the diary's loss is the reader's gain, and I include myself in that. Where can listeners find you online, Olga? I know you're on Twitter because you and I are often exchanging things on Twitter.
Right. My handle is BOWLGA Bolga. I'm on various social media platforms like Twitter and Instagram. And I have a website. It's my last name, which is ZILBERBORG.com, Zilberborg.com.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we will certainly link all that in the notes, but I'm afraid that's all we have time for today. But I want to thank Olga Zilberberg for spending this time with us to talk about the emigre experience, writing, motherhood, family, and her wonderful collection of short stories, Like Water and Other Stories, which is out this autumn and is available at wherever fine books are sold. I'm your host, Jennifer Yeremieva. And Olga, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Jennifer. It was a true pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, it's been great. And thank you to you, our listeners, for tuning in, and tune in next time when I'll be back with another great interview with another great author about another great book, as will my colleagues at the New Books Network. Thank you very much.